Osiris.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hey everybody, it's Zach here. I know we're all getting ready to hunker down for Christmas, but since we're off for a few more weeks before new episodes come out, I wanted to rebroadcast our holiday episode from last year with Tulsa's talented new wave rockabilly songwriter and accidental master of fractious festive holiday goodness, J.D. McPherson. Maybe I'm a Grinch or a Grump, I just don't love Christmas music. It's the same 10 songs played on loop from Thanksgiving on. But then came an album called Socks by J.D. McPherson. And while you might say that 2020 should be the last year we are pushing more sonic merriment down our earholes, JD's Socks remains a shining example of subverting an often saccharine and sickeningly consumerist tradition by making a record that is powerfully and playfully honest. It examines what we feel at Christmas time for real: disappointment, loneliness, drunkenness, lust, and gluttony, and most of all, the feeling of high expectations never fully realized. Albums like Socks, much like Mariah Carey's masterpiece in the early 1990s, for me are a once-in-a-blue-moon, once-in-a-generation occurrence. A Christmas record that I secretly play in my car in July, screaming along to Skinny Santa as the sun scorches the 405 freeway, or smiling along to the cheeky heartsick Every Single Christmas, which he wrote with Nicole Atkins, who was on this very show a few months back and may have written my favorite album of 2020 in Italian Ice. It's a bit hard to explain, but JD's record does something that I really, really need in this dark time of the year. It makes me blindingly happy every time it's on. And how rare is a transcendent Christmas album? Well, maybe it's as rare as the great convergence of Saturn and Jupiter, which me and my wife watched last night from a neighbor's telescope. The last time these two planets could be seen smooching in the sky with the naked eye, March 4th, 1226, an event believed to be the basis for the earlier Star of Bethlehem in the nativity story of the Gospel of Matthew that guided the three wise men to Christ's manger. 1226 was the year that Francis of Assisi died, and Genghis Khan and his Golden Horde, as they were called, swept across the plains of Asia. Do yourself a favor, put on the album Socks, buy yourself a vinyl from your favorite out-of-work band, and maybe check out our new Dust Bowl Revival video of Funky Christmas. It'll make you feel as powerful as Genghis Khan. And if you're feeling friendly, please subscribe and write a review of our fair podcast on iTunes. New episodes are coming in January, and I can't wait for you to see what we're cooking up. That's it for me. Stay safe, stay creative, and here he is now, the talented Tulsa master of Christmas mayhem, J.D. McPherson.
Santa, how could you let me down? It doesn't slip or slide or spring or make a sound that rocks. Hey, why'd you stuff my stocking with a lousy pair of socks?
You know, your bus broke down, but you still made it here, and I'm super glad.
Thanks. We only were in the 10 minutes late, even. Like, we had all... I mean,
should take some Ubers from San Diego?
We had a sprinter come get us, but what we had to do is that because the bus broke down in the very narrow alley behind the Belly Up in Solana Beach,
yeah.
The band and then, like, maybe... five or six other people from nearby businesses had to pick up the trailer. We had to empty out the trailer, pick up the trailer, and move it over 3 feet so that we could get a U-Haul truck in there to get it. Despite all of that, we still made it within 10 minutes of load-in time. So cheers to the tour management.
Well done. You're a little far from home, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm pretty far. I live in Nashville.
And you're originally from Oklahoma?
Yeah, from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. I was raised in southeast Oklahoma, but spent long enough that I could say I'm from Broken Arrow.
is Broken Arrow in Buffalo Valley, or is Buffalo Valley a separate thing?
No, Buffalo Valley is where I grew up.
Yeah.
That was where my folks' ranch is.
Right.
And I was born in Tulsa, and Broken Arrow is a suburb of Tulsa.
Right.
So after college, I moved to Tulsa.
It feels like there's a lot of really amazing roots artists coming out of Oklahoma. A lot of my favorites, Parker Millsap and
yep.
John Moreland
mm-hmm.
and
John Fulbright's from there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, there's always been a lot of kind of a wellspring of talent out of Oklahoma. But like the last few years is when they decided to start going and visiting other states.
Cause yeah.
when I was growing up there was a ton of amazing musicians and artists, but they didn't leave Oklahoma. They just didn't maybe play Texas here and there.
Is enough of a scene?
No, they just, I don't know what it is. I really can't explain. They either moved away or they just stayed and played once in a while. But there was like a little crop a few years ago that started touring and getting out and seeing the world a little bit. So I was, I know all of those folks that you mentioned, and they're like incredible people. We toured with John Moreland before we couldn't, have him as an opener anymore.
Yeah.
And, that was really, really cool. That was a really good run. And Parker's, I know Parker really well. Fulbright has kind of made his bed in Tulsa, though. He's staying there. He bought a house in the Brady District. And
I got to think the cost of living is just right down there.
It is really nice, man. It is it is very doable.
One-bedroom apartment, like, in a good part of Tulsa. What do you think?
Under 1,000, for sure. Like, if it's a pretty good one. In Nashville, a $600,000 or $700,000 house is about $150,000 to $200,000 in Tulsa. So I haven't rented in a while, so I couldn't tell you the exact rent number, but yeah, the cost of living in Tulsa is much better.
I first heard of you actually when we played a festival together with my band Dust Bowl Revival. I don't think you and I talked, but I was struck by you immediately at this American Roots Festival in Chicago at a
the one at
Fitzgerald's
in Berwyn.
Yeah. And I was just sort of transfixed watching you, because it felt like getting to see Elvis before the schlock. You know, like when it was real, like down home and dirty,
uh-huh.
and just the Sun Records sound, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, did you always play in a certain sort of vintage style that you wanted to emulate and then make your own? Or is it something that came organically?
No, because I was all over the map into what I listened to growing up, because I was totally isolated from anything resembling any kind of scene or whatever you want to call it. So I was listening to Bauhaus, Slayer, and Madonna simultaneously. Like, yeah. There wasn't anybody to tell me that I couldn't listen to anything. But, like, I'm not really sure where it came from, but approaching music in kind of a historical context was a big deal to me. Finding out that, Jimmy Page was into Duane Eddy.
Mm.
I was like, well, I want to know who Duane Eddy is. That kind of an idea really didn't seem like a big stretch to me. Most musicians worth some salt really don't see time spans or decades produced to be any sort of inhibitor on whether or not you're interested in listening to it.
Right.
It's just crazy to me to think that because Kind of Blue was recorded a few decades ago, that's not a relevant record. It's insane to me.
Yeah.
So that was always a thing, even as a kid, that I never really saw a distinction between rock and roll in the 70s and rock and roll in the 50s, except for sonically. It still had kind of the same attitude was the most important thing. And I was just always more interested in sonics than I was when something was produced.
Yeah.
Kind of hard to explain that, because I know obviously there's a difference, but it didn't really ever jar. It wasn't ever jarring to listen to one thing next to something else right. that came later and feel like they needed to be separated.
Well, I think, like, you know, American roots music for me should encompass a wider range of what we think of, just like, you know, folkies playing acoustic guitars.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, all the way from blues and gospel music from the South going into hip hop, you know, like that is a uniquely American rooted music.
Yeah.
You know, it's like sure our is. Art form, you know? And I think, you know, you have a lot of contrasts, you know, in your history going from, you know, working on your family's cattle ranch mm-hmm. to getting, you know, getting a master's degree, you know, at Tulsa University in media and doing, you know, art installations. And so, that's two huge different worlds.
Yeah. All of that, again, all of that stuff was more, it was more just about like creative production. Because I would be in art school and I'd take off for 2 weeks to do a tour.
Right.
And I didn't understand why they would get upset when I came back.
Yeah.
Like, where were you? Well, I was doing stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. I know that's ridiculous, but at the time, planning and making a tour happen wasn't something that seemed out of step with what the curriculum was offering. I don't know. I didn't expect to get in trouble.
Yeah, I'm out making art.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it was just one of those things where creative production was all kind of the same thing. I always had bands since I was 16. Even when I was in grad school, I was making.
What was your first band called?
First band was called Slippy, which was named after the frog character in Star Fox, which was the new Super Nintendo Entertainment System came out, and we were so stoked about Star Wars, or not Star Wars, but Star Fox, because it was it looked like kind of polygon,
yeah,
3D, and that was a big deal for Buffalo Valley, Oklahoma. We didn't have like too many arcades to visit, so that name came from that, and then it was kind of me and one other friend had that band going, and we had a Tascam 4-track. We made tapes, records, albums there. And then another friend wanted to be involved, so we started another band with the same members. That was called The Fjords. That was like kind of more influenced by hardcore music, like Black Flag and
yeah.
Angry Samoans. So we had like three bands at the same time, same members, but they were different styles and different names.
That's interesting. Yeah,
you got no audience, you got nobody to play with. It's what you get to do. So,
did you, at a certain point, feel like the music was taking over your heart and soul?
Yeah, I always tried to make that. That was always a priority. I think it was just more of the immediacy of it was why I wanted to do that more. So the art world is kind of a drag.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a ton of joie de vivre in that world, and it's a lot of talking about things instead of action.
Yeah.
And the tyranny of the artist statement, like if you make a work and you have it available for public viewing, there's this agreement that you're going to explain that and hang it on the wall, and it doesn't make any sense. And then, I don't know, just playing gigs on the weekend was so much more of a fulfilling thing. I don't know. There was a point where I sort of realized that there was a path I was on that was going to lead me more and more into the music side of things than keep making.
I want to talk about speaking of art, your album covers for a second.
Uh-huh.
Right? Because listening to your records, it feels like there's this interesting through line of an underlying ominous storm brewing underneath this sort of dance party in the parlor, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's these themes that I'm seeing of like the roof being blown off, mm-hmm. the thunder, people have to be careful and beware and watch out.
Yeah.
But also let's let the good times roll in the meantime. But like watch your back the whole time.
Well, that's
the danger that's always lurking almost behind your songs.
I would say that being in high school, David Lynch movies were a huge influence on me.
Me too.
That was a really big deal when I found some of that. It's almost like my part of my brain turned on that hadn't been there before. I was really into movies, and I had I would watch anything I could get my hands on, which was tough where I lived. But once I saw Blue Velvet, that was like, oh my God, because it was a version of the 50s that was like perverted into this almost like Francis Bacon expressionist painting where there's like bleeding heads and severed ears and
the ants crawling across the screen.
Right. It's that kind of did something. So there was always that thing was going to end up being in there, I think. I never really thought about that till.
Well, and Lynch takes a lot of the 50s music specifically in Mulholland Drive and sort of rips off the sort of smile. Mm-hmm. So you have to be like, what tortured soul is behind this grinning blonde beauty that's dancing around on your television screen?
I think he
screen.
Uses a lot of it as juxtaposition too, where he'll take the kind of naive, he'll take the super naive kind of lyrical stuff that sort of pop schmaltz and then put that up against some really horrifying imagery.
Right.
So he'll plays with a lot of that stuff. And, you know, just his whole thing is was Mel Brooks called him Jimmy Stewart from Mars. So he's like, whole thing is kind of based in that kind of old Hollywood kind of classic style.
Did you ever see his website that he had for a few years?
I was a member of that website when I was in college. Yeah, he would actually pop up on there once in a while and talk in all capital letters.
What was the thing he did where he would just say the weather and what was happening that day?
That was an ongoing project where just every day he would report the weather from his office.
Yeah,
and almost every day it was just, you know, it's bright and sunny today in Los Angeles, California. Yeah. By golly, or some cloud cover. You know, real straight every day the same. And then one day he'd show up and he'd have this like sculpture of like a rabbit head on his head and smoke coming out of the screen. And that was the weather report for the day. So sometimes he'd throw you a curveball.
If one song of yours could be placed in a David Lynch movie, which one do you think would fit?
Probably, it would probably be A Gentle Awakening off the first record.
Dude, I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
A Mournful Serenade.
Yeah.
Farmers on the Plains, Waking in a Lucid Dream. Did that song come from your rural upbringing and sort of the tensions that come from an isolated life?
Well, that song just sort of wrote itself. I wasn't thinking too much. I mean, it's obviously a kind of a apocalyptic, at least like a conceptually apocalyptic setup. But the music came first on that, and then when I started, I think I wrote most of the lyrics the night before, and it just kind of stream of consciousness happened that way. And I never really thought too much about that one, but it definitely, I mean, we ended up shooting a video. That's my that's where I grew up, and so maybe even subconsciously that's in there somewhere.
The people on the city streets, the farmers on the plains, all walking in a lucid dream while the sky is set aflame. They soon will hear quiet tune, so peaceful and serene. Then they may soon maze into a gentle.
Yeah, I mean, that image of the sky set aflame, you know, and in one hand it could be just a beautiful sunset over the farm, but it seems like, especially knowing what we know now about here in California, with the sky is often aflame.
Yeah.
It feels like, this end of days element creeping in. And I'm curious what you think the end of days would look like if it comes in your lifetime.
Oh, end of days, huh? Well, if there is an end of days, it's just going to be a really long, painful process. I don't think an end of days is going to be everybody's like, oh, I should have.
Yeah.
It's going to be a more of a long, painful rip of the Band-Aid. I hate to be, but I mean, I just think it's going to get, if there is an end of days, I don't know if it would be in our lifetime, but it's going to be, there's going to be a point where people realize that there's already been something kind of brewing and it's gonna keep going that way. That's so dark. Sorry.
Did you grow up religious?
Yeah, well, I mean, my parents are both preachers, so wow. I grew up in church. I learned to play music pretty much in church.
Pentecostal?
Post-Pentecostal. It was a non-denominational. My mother was the minister.
How was that power dynamic between your parents?
They were really cool. Well, like, my dad didn't really want me to be into rock music. He was into jazz, though. I remember one time I showed up with a Jimi Hendrix tape, and for some reason I thought my dad would like that, and he didn't. He just said, "Do you have any idea how he died?" You know? Yeah. And I'm like, "Well, do you know how? I mean, you're listening to John Coltrane."
Yeah.
You know, like
Charlie Parker.
Yeah, I fail to see the difference between those two things, but whatever. So it was that was the thing. But my mom was always cool with everything. She always made sure I had a working amplifier, and I remember one time my little punk band in high school played at this public amphitheater that we signed up for in McAllister, Oklahoma. And we started within 10 minutes. Cops showed up to shut it down, and my mom was there and introduced herself as the pastor of the Word of Life Church in Page, Oklahoma. And she asked them to let us play, you know. She's like, "Well, at least I know where my kids are," you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they're doing something constructive that shouldn't make them stop. So that was my life. I didn't really see any, I was encouraged heavily to kind of do what I was doing. It was cool.
That's awesome. I mean, it would be remiss of me, since this is the last episode of our Christmas season,
mm-hmm.
to not dive a little bit into socks, which I think is the most insanely enjoyable Christmas album
in the last 20 years.
You know, there's Mariah, and uh-huh. then there's J.D. McPherson's socks.
Yeah, let's get those sales up to Mariah level, and we'll be all right.
My wife got me the vinyl for Christmas uh-huh. last year. It has been pretty much on loop, even not in Christmas time.
That's good. That's, well, we were, when we were making the record, we were kind of going to issue some of the things that are normally in Christmas material, like sleigh bells and things like that, to where we have actually heard a couple of SoundScan reports report like sales of that record will be happening in like May, June, which is great.
I mean,
I love it.
It is unnecessarily enjoyable.
Right,
like good. It is like it's no there's no reason for it to be as good as it is. Like,
well,
it feels like, honestly, like I could listen to it, and I do listen to it at times. It's in the rotation of the rest of the year because there's a snark and a
mm-hmm.
a darkness to it. Honestly, the title track is sort of, I think, examining the idea of expectations
yeah.
and disappointment. And that the Christmas season often brings this expectation that we're going to kind of finally get everything we want, and our family's all going to be together. And really, that's not how it usually is.
Well, know? There's...
You're going to get socks
it's in a
your
whole, stocking. It's a whole myriad of emotions, especially in the kid. It's almost like one of those things that's so... Nobody really thinks about it. They just go along with it. But if you stop to think about it, like everything else, it's totally absurd. We cultivate this environment for children in which they're expected to believe that, you know, well, first of all, we're putting a giant plant that goes to the ceiling in the house. We're going to hang things on it.
We're going to cut it down.
We're going to cut it down, and we're going to put it in our living room.
Yeah.
And then there's a, you know, person breaks into our house essentially in the middle of the night and leaves you things.
Yeah.
And
did you believe in Santa when you were little?
No, when I was 5 years old, I was a pretty good reader, and I climbed up onto the bookshelf and pulled the Mother's Encyclopedia off the shelf and started reading about it. And I remember in the same sitting, I read about different vaccines.
Okay.
I learned about what vaccines were, and then I also learned about Santa Claus. And I
like, were you devastated? Were you like, oh, now I know?
I was furious.
Oh.
I took the book into my mom. I was like waving the book at her, like, explain this, you
yeah.
know. So, but it's so funny that, you know, you there's this kind of happy, sentimental, magical stuff happening, but then there's also this sort of there's this cultivation of almost selfishness, and then Yeah.
It's a Coca-Cola created holiday in a lot of ways, right? It's
I love, don't get me wrong, I'm a Christmas fanatic, but it is funny to, if you think about certain aspects of it, it's a big sell. It's a pretty big thing to ask of somebody to buy into.
Early Christmas morning, sneaky as can be, I creep across the carpet and I peek under the tree. Pick out a gift from mom to me and bring it to my ear. Give it a little shimmy shake and what do I hear? Socks.
Socks.
This is the worst gift I ever got. It doesn't beep or buzz or bob or rattle in the box. And why'd you waste the paper on a lousy pair of socks?
Do you remember the first amazing gift that really rocked your world when you were a little kid?
I mean, it was the golden age of toys. In my opinion, it was the golden age of toys. Like, I was right at the right age for Masters of the Universe, Star Wars, G.I. Joe, and Transformers, and Thundercats. All were happening at the same time because Return of the Jedi was out. So I was old enough, I was young enough to catch the last bit of Star Wars toys. I was the beginning. I mean, I was in Toys R Us, and I got the first, you know, run of Masters of the Universe, G.I. Joes. I got G.I. Joes for, I mean, it was like the best. So getting castles and getting vehicles for all of those lines were like the best thing ever. But the most excited I ever got was a Game Boy. That was more even than a Nintendo or an Atari or anything that came before it. I was just so stoked that I could play in the car. I could play Tetris in the car.
Well, there's this song, you know, Hey Skinny Santa, mm-hmm. right, where you're kind of playing with the image of this Santa who's not fat enough for the holiday yet. And he has to, like, I love that he has to go to Chicago and eat all the deep dish, you know?
Well, that's...
It's so funny because you're like... And then he gets fatter and fatter, but he's still not quite there.
Yeah. Well, he gets at the very end, he gets there. But that song, most of that song was written by our sax guy, Doug, who he had like 10 or 11 verses. And I was like, it's not going to be like a Yes tune. We got to get this down to like 3 minutes. So we ended up focusing on like music towns, blues towns. Chicago, Memphis, and New Orleans.
Yeah. Speaking of deep dish, what is your favorite town that you tour to food wise?
Does it have to be in the United States?
No.
Okay. San Sebastian, Donostia in northern Spain. It's just, you can't get anything bad there. It's impossible.
I was in northern Spain twice this year for some reason. The seafood up there is just, they don't even need to put anything on it.
No, it's incredible.
It's just like lemon and salt and like enjoy.
It's the best thing. In the state, I mean, I have to say my diet has changed a lot. I'm on a vegan diet now, so I eat a lot of different things. But overall, the South is still my favorite place to eat. In the United States, like, I love
vegan for environmental reasons or health reasons?
For health reasons, and you know, it's not gonna hurt to,
yeah,
to, it's kind of good in a lot of ways, but I got some pretty serious health things I need to start paying attention to. So some friends of mine doing the vegan diet, and I kind of talked to them about it, and I was like, I'm gonna try it. And I've been doing it for a while now, and I feel fantastic, and it's a little tough on the road from time to time, but yeah, it's going okay.
In between the major cities can probably be challenging.
Yeah, it's when you hit the Costco and you buy a whole bunch of rice and a whole bunch of lentils and make batches and sustain yourself.
Speaking of your bus breaking down, is there a particularly harrowing road trip that you've been on recently on a tour?
Our first bus tour was really bad. We left Nashville in like one of the worst ice storms. The bus broke down because I don't even know how it happened, but something froze under the bus and it wouldn't shift or something. I don't know how it worked, but we ended up getting to the first gig in time to load in right after the opener was finished. So we loaded in after the opener was done. We set up and just started playing. And but that weather on that whole trip was really bad.
Some of those mountain passes in Colorado,
oh man,
are just yeah. white knuckle, man.
Well, our drummer and tour manager drove a van with all of our gear up to Seattle to start the tour, so they had to go through Utah and Colorado and stuff, and it was pretty hairy.
Did you get any tornadoes down in Oklahoma growing up?
Well, in the month of May, pretty much every day.
Every day?
Pretty much, yeah. Especially if you live in the central part of Oklahoma, if you live in Oklahoma City or Moore. The town of Moore has been wiped off the face of the earth I don't even know how many times. I mean, it's just, it's insane. Like, when I was first starting to tour, my wife and our little girls, we were in Broken Arrow. I had a tornado shelter put in our garage where it's like underground and you like it's under a car and you climb down inside it and pull the lid over you. And I'd be on the road and I never really thought about it that much until we got the shelter. I would get a call almost every day saying, "We're in the shelter, we're in the shelter."
Jesus.
Yeah, it's a crazy way to live.
It definitely makes you think about luck and your place in the universe, you know, like if you were 10 minutes away at the wrong time.
I will say if the universe is indifferent, it's at least conniving.
Where did that song Lucky Penny come from?
I had that little riff, but I had...
It's a headbanger, man.
Well, it was just played like on a... Well, I've got a guitar here. Just like, so it just sounded like that. I hadn't run the fuzz pedal through it yet. And I played it for a couple of different producers and nobody ever was like, yeah. But I got the fuzz pedal and once that was on, it became a thing. And I was like, okay, we got to follow this through.
Trouble finds me no matter where I run. Do you think that people have luck or bad luck in their blood, or is it something that you create?
No, there is an infinite number of decisions that you make or don't make, and things just happen.
Do you consider yourself a lucky person?
Well, I'm very fortunate.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, anyone that is able to have a vocation and an avocation is lucky, but when you can combine those two things, that's winning. You know what I mean? I mean, I would do it. I'd still be doing it for free. You know, I would did it forever for free, and just to, in the middle of my 30s, suddenly be gifted this thing that I wanted to do at. Yeah, super, super grateful. I don't know if I can say it's luck or what, but I am grateful.
What do your kids think about you playing music?
They're just so used to everything. They don't, you know, they do get excited if they hear something in a restaurant or for in a store. They get really excited about that because then it's like, oh, you know, they don't see me like stressing out packing and all that kind of stuff.
Tell me about recording in RCA Studio B in Nashville and making a Undivided Heart and Soul.
Well, that was a series of unfortunate events that ended up being really wonderful because we were trying to make the record. I hadn't finished writing it. Had a producer that was signed on. That was a really like a big producer. I won't say who it was, but
Rick Rubin.
Wasn't Rick Rubin, but we got in there.
Yeah.
And after day one, that producer canceled.
Oh,
canceled
man.
The whole session. Wanted to use all different musicians and just wasn't feeling it. So it basically blew through our whole budget because we had booked lodging and all this kind of stuff for everybody. Not everybody lived in town yet. So I was like trying to figure out what we were going to do, how we were going to do it. And a buddy of mine that was engineering the record just said, hey, why don't we just ask Studio B because they're a museum. Maybe we can record a couple of songs there. And ended up, I think what happened was I had just played a gratis performance for the Country Music Hall of Fame. So maybe somebody there still remembered my name because they said, yes, you can use it. And when we went in there, we were only supposed to be able to do like 3 songs. And there were certain rules we had to go by. First of all, you had to record at night. Second of all, you had to get a Hall of Famer to be on the record. Like, they have these kind of rules, and which I was cool with all of that. But once we got there, the studio manager was like, let's just do a whole record. We're kind of bored.
Yeah.
Because it's a museum. It's museum tours all morning.
I mean, it's an incredible confluence of sounds in this record that I think really gelled, you know, in your sound, you know. And how did Dan Moled from Lucius end up being involved?
Needed somebody to come in and be a moderator. Somebody needed to be in there to kind of save me from myself. And if I was going with an idea, to get me back on track, if I was like not going to pursue that idea because it was scared that it wasn't going to sound like what we always sounded like. That was a big thing for me to wrestle with, was, you know, some of these things are coming out kind of loud, and I needed somebody there to, and I trust Dan implicitly. He's like a musical brother, and he was far out aside enough to where he could be objective and be like, I don't care what you think. This sounds cool. Like, you know, we're doing this. And it worked out great. We went hard and fast, and we were loading in every night, tearing down every night because they had tours the next day. But it was a whirlwind, but man, I wouldn't trade it for anything.
I want to talk about one last song, and then we'll let you go here because I know you're playing across the street. Crying's just a thing that you do.
Uh-huh.
You know, again, it kind of goes back to this thing that I'm seeing in your music of, it sounds real upbeat and fun, and it's got that tinkling piano going on, and then it's talking about the danger of telling every stranger and something sinister in your blood. Mm-hmm. And like hell is like a flood, right? It's like there's these almost biblical darkness hovering over the party.
You're gonna laugh when you find out what that song is about. I always had a crush on Lilith from Cheers and Frasier when I was a kid. That was my big crush.
Niles's wife?
No, and that's Maris. You never see Maris. Oh,
right.
It was Frasier's ex-wife.
Okay.
B.B. Newirth player.
Yeah.
And,
that is a really specific crush.
Yeah, I have them. I get them. but she was this almost like emotionless, wore black a lot.
Yeah.
Had her hair in a bun, kind of a librarian. She was a psychiatrist in the show. But I always just thought about what it must be like to be with someone who cannot be consoled. You know, so that whole song, I wrote that song with Butch Walker. I was like, man, I'd like to do this song about...
can never be satisfied.
Yeah. I've always sort of been... found myself in relationships with people that are tough, you know, difficult. Like, I seem to be drawn to difficult. Not anymore. My wife is great, but, like, in the past, I always found myself drawn into being with difficult people. And so, yeah, that song was... I just pictured Lilith and wrote to that character, and that's what that was about.
You're at the widest wedding, that black is very slimming, but everybody's staring at you. You're sipping your Darjeeling and staring at the ceiling. You dream about it splitting in two. And every time the wind blows, you open up the windows, the china crashes down on the floor. It's really got me hurting, I'm trembling and I'm cursing, I'm rattled more than ever before. You say there's nothing I could do to ever satisfy you, 'cause crying's just a thing that you do.
If you could give a Christmas wish to the world right now, what would it be?
Okay, so maybe I don't want to say world peace because that's what I really want, but I'll tell you what, I really wish that everybody could travel more. I wish that everyone had more of an opportunity to go other places, even if it was just 150, 200 miles away, because nothing has expanded my worldview, nothing has improved my life, my quality of life, and how I feel about other people than traveling and seeing other people's lives. Everyone is essentially the same, and you know, once you actually meet people that are different from yourself, it really grants you the opportunity to look at yourself and what other people might think about you too. So I don't know, I think that if everyone would could see a little bit more, travel a little bit more, meet people who aren't necessarily from the same walk of life they are from, that would make the world a lot better of a place.
If you could throw your own music festival in any place you've ever been, maybe it's San Sebastian in Spain, where would it be?
I'd love to have a festival. In fact, I've looked into it a couple of times. I'd love to have a festival near Pawhuska, Oklahoma, near where the Osage Nation is.
Mm.
Because I grew up in Oklahoma, and it's like the largest per capita population of Native Americans. And to a lot of people, Native American people they're either invisible or they're some kind of fantasy.
Or an object of pity or poverty.
Or some kind of magical thing.
Yeah.
And growing up in that way, it's such an important thing that Americans know about indigenous people.
Hmm.
They really need to know about them. And so I always thought it would be really great to have a really eclectic festival, sort of like what Pickathon is up in Oregon, but in Pawhuska, Oklahoma, the seat of the Osage Nation, and have the Osage tribe be a part of it, help run it, you know, just for people to kind of know that it's there. I don't know. That's something I've thought about.
Who would be the first five people you would book on your music festival?
I'd love to have Marty Stewart's band there.
The Superlatives?
Yeah, Fabulous Superlatives is like an incredible band. I'd love to book X.
Mm. DJ Bonebreak?
Yeah, DJ Bonebreak.
He hangs around here.
Really? I'd love to have Ken Booth. Is a Jamaican soul singer. He's like one of my favorite singers. I'd love to have Irma Thomas.
Mm.
Stiff Little Fingers. I don't know. I'm just naming bands that I haven't made that list, but it'd be really eclectic. It'd be a little pinch of everything, and it wouldn't be based on whether someone had a record out or just what is the best evening of music I could possibly summon up.
It'd be awesome.
Yeah. Maybe it'll happen one day.
Would you like to take us out with a song?
Yeah, I think this is one I can do. Oh, look, a guitar appeared. I think this is one I can do by myself. I haven't done much of this.
What's it called?
Ugly Sweater Blues.
On the world's greatest modern Christmas album, Socks.
Thank you, buddy. Appreciate this.
Don't make me wear that old thing again. Hand-knitted Christmas trees and a silly snowman. No matter if I refuse, I'm singing these ugly sweater blues. Mama, why can't you see I feel like a fool? Green elves with snowflakes and scratchy alpaca wool. Maybe you heard the news. I got these ugly sweater blues. Another year, another sweater, and another holiday soiree. Mama hears the people laughing while the presents are unwrapping. She's not even sorry. Mama, don't make me wear that old thing again. Hand-knitted Christmas trees and a silly snowman. No matter if I refuse, I'm singing these ugly sweater blues. Driving to Atlanta for an interview with Santa, I can hear him say, hey, that kid is back again and dig his ugly cardigan. Oh, what a shame. Mama, don't make me wear that old thing again. Bright red with sleigh bells and a gingerbread man. Corduroys and pointy shoes. I'm singing these ugly sweater blues. done paid all my dues. I'm singing these ugly sweater blues.
There he goes now, Mr. J.D. McPherson. You can go to jdmcpherson.com for his music and his tour dates. His Christmas Socks tour is rolling through America. There's only a few dates left: Chicago, Minneapolis, and finishing in Nashville on the 22nd of December at the Basement East. If you hop over to thebluegrasssituation.com, you'll find that J.D. McPherson wrote a wonderful piece called Gig Bag, where he tells us what he needs on the road, such as his Muhammad Ali jump rope. My Gang Dust Bowl Revival will have a rare month off, but that's really because it's the calm before the storm. The storm being our new record, which comes out at last January 31st on 30 Tigers. It will be called Is It You? Is It Me? And there are three singles already available: Runaway, Mirror, and Enemy. If you followed along our journey through the 10 years plus that we've been together, you will be astounded by what you hear in these songs. Does it feel like an entire symphony orchestra and a choir are accompanying us every song? It kinda does. January 29th, we launch our record release tour at the Sinclair in Boston, and we are playing some bucket list venues on this one, guys. February 7th at the 930 Club in Washington, D.C. February 8th at the Paramount Theater in Bristol, Tennessee. And on the West Coast, February 20th at one of my favorite places on earth, Mississippi Studios in Portland, Oregon, and February 28th at the Fillmore in San Francisco, and home at the Troubadour in LA, February 29th. I hope to see you on the Leap Day. Last but not least, I would like to tell you about a couple podcasts that have been put out by wonderful artists that I've talked to on this show, like B. Beeman. 1 year ago, he released an innovative concept record podcast called Peace of Mind. He talks to intellectuals and authors and scientists and activists, and he integrates his songs piece by piece throughout the podcast. Also, if you listen to our episode with Chris Shiflett, the lead guitar player from the Foo Fighters a few months back, you'll know that he has a podcast called Walking the Floor. And if you want to know what the rock and roll star lifestyle is really like, listen to Chris. He knows what's up. Okay, one last thing. It's the holidays. Everybody's buying Christmas presents and Hanukkah presents like crazy. Do me a favor. Instead of maybe buying one more thing from the corporate behemoths, support your local bands and your local artists. If you go to dustbowlrevival.com, you'll see that we have really cool limited edition violet vinyl and the bundles that go with it, with t-shirts and posters. There's all sorts of fun stuff coming your way. Support bands. They need your help. And it'll make you feel great. The show on the road is hosted by me, Zach Lupitan, and produced by the handsome Hawaiian Chris Jacobs, with support from the Bluegrass Situation team. If you love the show on the road, please leave us a review or rating over at itunes.com/showontheroad. Tell your friends, and also be sure to check out BGS's ever-growing collection of podcasts up right now on thebluegrasssituation.com. The show on the road is a part of the BGS Podcast Network. This is Zach Lupitan. See you on the trail.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
I feel like Chicago's.
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles. The Wrath of the Buzzard. PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.